Well, on August 13th, 1999, less than 9 months after its commercial launch, a company that had spent more money than any private venture in history filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Iridium LLC had burned through $5 billion, building a constellation of 66 satellites orbiting Earth. The phones designed to connect to them cost $3,000 each. Calls were billed at $7 per minute. And when the company collapsed, fewer than 20,000 people on the entire planet were using them. This is not a story about technology that failed to work. Every single satellite performed exactly as designed. This is a story about three decisions made years apart by different people that locked Iridium into a path it could not escape. By the time the flaws became visible, 11 years of work and the largest private capital raise in telecommunications history had already committed to assumptions that would prove catastrophically wrong. The question is not why Iridium failed. The question is why no one stopped it. The idea originated inside Motorola in 1987, not with executives, but with engineers. The story, repeated in every early presentation, involved a frustrated Motorola engineer trying to place a call from a vacation spot in the Caribbean where cellular service did not exist. "Why," he asked, "couldn't a phone work anywhere on Earth?" The engineer's name was Barry Berdiger, and he worked in Motorola's Strategic Electronics Division in Chandler, Arizona. Together with Ray Leopold and Ken Peterson, Berdiger sketched a solution: a network of low Earth orbit satellites passing calls between themselves, creating a mesh that covered the globe. No ground stations required except at network control. No gaps. True global coverage. Motorola, at the time, was the undisputed leader in mobile communications. The company had invented the commercial cellular phone. It built infrastructure for networks worldwide. When Berdiger's team brought the satellite concept to senior leadership in 1988, Motorola saw an opportunity to extend that dominance into a realm its competitors could not follow. This was the first decision. Motorola would build it. In June 1990, Motorola filed an application with the Federal Communications Commission for a license to operate a constellation of 77 satellites. The project was named Iridium, after the element with atomic number 77. Later, engineers optimized the design to 66 satellites, but the name stuck. The technical ambition was staggering. Each satellite would cross-link with four others, forming a dynamic relay network 780 kilometers above Earth. The satellites would hand off calls seamlessly as they passed overhead. They would operate autonomously, with onboard processing that determined routing. Nothing like this had ever been attempted in commercial telecommunications. The estimated cost in 1990, $3.4 billion. Motorola would not fund it alone. Instead, the company would create a separate entity, Iridium LLC, and raise capital from strategic partners. The investors included Sprint, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, and major telecom operators from around the world. By 1994, Iridium had commitments totaling over $1.6 billion in equity financing, with billions more in planned debt. Here's the second decision. Iridium locked its design in 1990 and committed to that architecture for the next decade. Satellite constellations require years of planning. Launches must be scheduled, frequencies allocated, regulatory approvals obtained from every country where service will operate, handset designs frozen so manufacturing can begin. Iridium's timeline stretched from concept in 1987 to projected commercial service in 1998. 11 years. During those 11 years, the world changed. In 1990, cellular networks covered parts of major cities in wealthy countries. Most of the world had no mobile service at all. Analysts projected that by 2000, fewer than 40 million people globally would own cell phones. The market for calls outside cellular coverage, they estimated, was enormous. Traveling executives, maritime shipping, remote industries, military and government operations. But cellular networks expanded faster than anyone predicted. By 1998, when Iridium finally launched commercial service, there were over 300 million cellular subscribers worldwide. Coverage extended across highways, suburbs, and secondary cities. Roaming agreements allowed phones to work across borders. The cellular footprint was not global, but it covered nearly everywhere that people with money to spend on expensive phone calls actually lived. Iridium's target market was shrinking even as the satellites launched. Worse, the cost assumptions built into Iridium's business model in 1990 reflected a world where mobile calls were rare and expensive. Early cellular service in the United States cost several dollars per minute. Iridium's $7 per minute rate seemed high, but not absurdly so. By 1998, cellular rates in competitive markets had fallen below 20 cents per minute. Some plans offered unlimited local calling. Iridium's pricing was not slightly more expensive than the alternative. It was 35 times more expensive, and the phones themselves were a problem. The Iridium 9500 handset weighed 1 pound. It required a clear view of the sky to connect. It did not work indoors, in cars, or in cities, with tall buildings blocking the satellites overhead. The battery lasted 4 hours on standby. The industrial design was functional, not elegant, and the retail price was $3,000. Cellular phones in 1998 were small, sleek, and increasingly affordable. Many were given away free with service contracts. Iridium's engineers had done exactly what they were asked to do. They had built a technological marvel, but the market had moved. In early 1996, 2 years before the first satellite launched, Iridium faced a choice. Internal projections showed subscriber growth was tracking below initial forecasts. Cellular coverage was expanding faster than expected. Some board members and investors questioned whether the original business case still held. Motorola and the consortium investors had already committed billions. Satellites were under construction. Launch contracts were signed. Handset production was beginning. Regulatory approvals, painstakingly negotiated in dozens of countries, were in place. The marketing machinery was ramping up. The third decision was to continue. Stopping would have meant writing off the investment. It would have meant admitting that the assumptions underlying a decade of work were wrong. And there was still hope. Yes, the consumer market looked weaker than expected, but there were other customers. Military contracts, remote industries, maritime shipping, emergency services, journalists in war zones. Iridium's marketing pivoted toward these niches. In November 1997, Iridium completed one of the largest initial public offerings in telecommunications history, raising $240 million. The company was valued at over $5 billion. The first satellites were already operational. The network was on schedule. On November 1, 1998, Iridium officially began commercial service. The launch was accompanied by a global marketing campaign. Print ads ran in business magazines. Television spots aired during major sporting events. The tagline, calling planet Earth. Iridium had projected it would need 52,000 subscribers to break even on operating costs while servicing its debt. The company publicly forecast 400,000 subscribers by the end of 1999, ramping to 5 million by 2002. By the end of 1998, 2 months into commercial service, Iridium had 15,000 subscribers. The problems compounded quickly. Subscribers who bought phones and activated service discovered the limitations. Dropped calls when satellites passed out of range. No indoor coverage. Difficulty connecting in urban areas. Customer complaints flooded call centers. Churn rates, the percentage of customers canceling service, ran far higher than projections. Iridium's network cost roughly $60 million per month to operate. Satellite maintenance, ground control, handset subsidies, and debt service created a burn rate that required massive subscriber growth to sustain. When growth stalled, the cash crisis became immediate. In March 1999, Iridium's CEO, Ed Stayano, resigned. He was replaced by John Richardson, a turnaround specialist. Richardson immediately began renegotiating supplier contracts, cutting marketing spend, and seeking additional capital. But the math was unforgiving. Even at 20,000 subscribers, the company was losing tens of millions per month. Motorola, Iridium's largest shareholder and primary creditor, faced its own dilemma. The parent company had already loaned Iridium hundreds of millions. It had guaranteed another billion in debt. If Iridium collapsed, Motorola would take massive losses. But continuing to fund Iridium meant pouring money into a business that showed no path to profitability. In June 1999, Motorola announced it would provide no additional funding beyond existing commitments. Without new capital, Iridium could not meet its debt obligations. On August 13, 1999, Iridium LLC filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. The filing listed assets of $4 billion, mostly the satellites themselves, and liabilities of over $3 billion. At the time of filing, Iridium had fewer than 20,000 paying subscribers. The bankruptcy raised a surreal question. What do you do with 66 functioning satellites orbiting Earth that nobody wants? Iridium's creditors initially considered deorbiting the constellation. The satellites were still operational, but the cost to maintain the network exceeded any realistic revenue forecasts. The U.S. government intervened. The Department of Defense had been using Iridium service for military communications in remote areas. Losing the network would eliminate a capability the Pentagon valued, particularly for operations in regions with no alternatives. In December 2000, a private investor group led by Dan Colasi, a former executive at Pan Am, acquired Iridium's assets out of bankruptcy for $25 million. The purchase price was less than the cost of a single satellite. The new entity, Iridium Satellite LLC, restructured the business model entirely. Instead of targeting mass market consumers, the company focused exclusively on niche users: government, military, maritime, aviation, and remote industries. Without the crushing debt load and with dramatically reduced operating costs, the restructured Iridium became profitable. The U.S. government signed long-term contracts worth hundreds of millions. Oil companies equipped remote facilities. Shipping companies installed terminals. The network, designed for a mass market that never materialized, found a sustainable niche, serving customers who had no alternative. In 2008, Iridium began launching a second-generation constellation, Iridium Next, to replace the aging original satellites. The new network came online in 2019. Iridium Communications, the successor company, went public again in 2009 and remains operational today, serving roughly a million subscribers worldwide. The collapse of the original Iridium was not a failure of engineering. The satellites worked. The technology performed as designed. The failure was in three decisions, each reasonable in isolation, that together locked the company into an unsustainable path. The first decision, to build the network, reflected Motorola's ambition and the genuine belief that mobile communications would expand globally. In 1988, that belief was not irrational. The second decision, to lock the design in 1990, was a necessity of satellite engineering. You cannot iterate a constellation in orbit the way you iterate software. But it created an 11-year gap between concept and execution, during which the world changed in ways the original assumptions did not anticipate. The third decision, to continue when early warning signs appeared, reflected the sunk cost fallacy at an extraordinary scale. Billions had been spent. Investors had committed. Regulatory approvals were in place. Stopping meant admitting failure before the product even launched. But continuing meant spending billions more on a business model that had already become obsolete. None of these decisions, individually, doomed Iridium. Together, they created a situation where the company launched a product 11 years in the making into a market that no longer existed. In the years after Iridium's bankruptcy, the telecommunications industry watched several other satellite ventures follow similar paths. Globalstar, a competing low Earth orbit system, filed for bankruptcy in 2002. ICO Global Communications, another satellite network, collapsed in 1999. Teledesic, a Bill Gates-backed satellite internet project, was abandoned before launch. The pattern was consistent: multi-billion dollar investments, years-long development cycles, and business models designed for a world that had moved on by the time the technology deployed. The lesson was clear, but painful. Long development cycles in fast-moving markets create risk that cannot be hedged. Technological success does not guarantee commercial success. And the larger the investment, the harder it becomes to admit when the original assumptions no longer hold. Iridium satellites are still up there, the second-generation constellation now fully operational. The network serves users who need connectivity where nothing else reaches. Researchers in Antarctica, vessels crossing the Pacific, military units in the field. The technology found its market, but it took a collapse, a fire sale, and a complete reset of expectations to get there. The original Iridium spent $5 billion to learn what the survivors already knew. It does not matter how well you build something if the world has moved on before you finish. Arif's title options. 1. Iridium, how a $5 billion satellite network collapsed in 9 months. 2. The rise and fall of Iridium, the most expensive telecom failure in history. 3. What happened to Iridium, the satellite company that spent billions and failed. 4. Iridium's $5 billion mistake, three decisions that destroyed a satellite empire. 5. The Iridium disaster. Y66. Working satellites couldn't save a $5 billion company. Description. In 1998, Iridium LLC launched a constellation of 66 satellites orbiting Earth, the culmination of 11 years of work and over $5 billion in investment. Less than 9 months later, the company filed for bankruptcy. This is the story of three decisions made by Motorola and immanent Iridium's leadership that locked the venture into a path it could not escape. The first decision committed Motorola to building the network. The second locked the design in 1990, creating an 11-year gap before launch. The third decision came when early warnings appeared. Continue or stop? The choice to continue launched a technological marvel into a market that had vanished. This documentary examines how Iridium satellites worked perfectly while the business collapsed, why the company burned through billions serving fewer than 20,000 customers, and how the network eventually found survival in a market its founders never intended. Subscribe for more deep dives into business history's most fascinating failures and unlikely revivals. Hashtags: Iridium, Chirp Business, History, Bankruptcy, Motorola Satellites, Telecom Industry, Business Failure, Corporate Strategy, Technology, Dyakichuk 1990s Investment Disaster, Jer Satellite Phone, Jer Business Documentary, Case Study, Entrepreneurship. Tags: Iridium Bankruptcy, Iridium Satellite Phone, Motorola Iridium, Satellite Constellation, Telecom Failure, Business Collapse, Corporate Bankruptcy, 1999, Iridium LLC, Satellite Network, Technology Failure, Business Case Study, Startup Failure, Venture Capital Disaster, Iridium Next, Dan Colasi, Telecommunications History, 1990s Technology, Business Documentary, Corporate Strategy, Worst Investments, Thumbnail Brief. Visual, split image showing an Iridium satellite in orbit on the left side, clean, futuristic, technological, and a bankruptcy court filing document stamped Chapter 11 on the right side. Alternatively, an Iridium satellite phone, the chunky 9500 model, positioned against a backdrop of satellites orbiting Earth, with a red downward arrow graphic overlay. Text overlay: 5 billion satellites bankruptcy, in bold white or yellow text, with black stroke shadow for maximum contrast, positioned in the upper third of the thumbnail to catch the eye while scrolling,